Thank you. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Usually I have a cup of coffee here as my kind of guide, but I haven't. So if I start shaking, it's because I truly am nervous. I use the coffee to stop me from shaking. Secondly, I've got my glass in my hand. If I take my glasses off, it's because you're scaring me. I don't want to be able to see you. So in the moment, they'll stay off. I'm the SO1J3, the operations officer of the Sand Joint Force Headquarters, a new headquarters that's about 18 months old. And we have used wargaming quite extensively, I think quite well, but I'll explain how and why that's happened. I think the badges on here should point you in the right direction. The top left-hand badge is the Joint Force Command. We sit under the Joint Force Command, and I'll come on to how that works out for us later within the MOD, the new four-star command within the headquarters, within the MOD. The bottom left-hand corner is the Joint Expeditionary Force, which represents the nations, partner nations from the UK, Netherlands, Norway, Denmark, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and now Finland, countries that have a common interest in certain parts of the world and are training together and trying to improve their interoperability. And actually, that's been very useful in terms of our wargaming experience. And the bottom right badge is the Combined Joint Expeditionary Force, which is a bilateral arrangement between Britain and France, where we have common interests. I raise those points is that we're not all things to all men, but we do have a lot of interest in our multinational and our international partners. And our top right-hand badge is probably the most significant badge, is that it's that's our heritage. That is the Combined Operations Badge from the Second World War, one that was taken on in the latter part of the 20th century by the Joint Force Headquarters, and the Standing Joint Force Headquarters Group has incorporated the Joint Force Headquarters, the Standing Joint Force Logistic Component Headquarters, and the new two-star SJF HQ, which I'll explain in a little bit more detail. But badges mean things in the same way words do. I'm going to get a little bit of introduce the group itself, talk about our wargaming journey, and a little bit about some of the insights we've brought about. The insights aren't necessarily just a list at the end. There is a list at the end, but I'll bring them out as we go through. So the group itself then, as I described, was under the command of Joint Forces Command in a new four-star headquarters. On the right-hand side, you can see that our three headquarters within the group all come under the daily command of the Director General Joint Force Development. The significance of that is he also commands the Defence Academy, which includes the Advanced Command and Staff College, the Higher Command and Staff College, and he also has command of the Doctrine Centre. So we are lucky in that we are, as operational level practitioners, we have access to the professional military educators and to the doctrine writers within his command, and he's able to kind of pull the levers to make that work. Unusually, on operations, we come under command. Unusually, we don't come under command of him when we're on operations. We come under command of the Chief of Joint Operations on the left-hand side, and the significance there is that we are disconnected in our in-barracks life from our operational chain of command, and we're designated on operations from our in-barracks chain of command. The dotted lines represent our taskings. So we don't get taskings from the Director General Joint Force Development, we get them directly from the Chief of Defence Staff through the Operations Directorate, and we also get them from the Chief of Joint Operations to conduct planning activities and reconnaissance for him. Significance of that is that we do have access to the resources in the Operations Directorate to support us or for us to support them, and we get our task for a series of activities there. And also we have access to the Chief of Joint Operations resources. We're co-located with the Chief of Joint Operations, it's kind of slightly complicated. The group itself is three headquarters, each which are complementary but are different and have got different roles. It's not just a case of doing the same thing but bigger, which people may have a misunderstanding. I'll start with the Joint Force Headquarters, the one that's most well known, responsible for delivering successful operations for the last 25 years or so, which has held extremely high readiness and is now really, really expert at non-combatant evacuation operations, humanitarian aid and disaster relief operations, and has led the way in creating the conditions by which the military and the civilian cooperation in UK government can take part at, you know, at the point of crisis. So we're really, really fascinating organisation. I worked there as a major a couple of years ago, and they've gone from strength to strength in developing their expertise in those two areas. The Standing Joint Force logistics component has regained its kind of its name as a theatre activation and force reception headquarters, where previously it had responsibility for humanitarian aid and disaster relief operations. It lost that responsibility because it went into the business of supporting operations in real time. It's particularly providing a lot of core activity for joint force support in Middle East, providing the drawdown headquarters for Iraq and the drawdown headquarters for Afghanistan for the British contributions in both those operations. So it's now kind of reset itself as a proper component headquarters in the organisation. But the two-star Stand Joint Force headquarters has been set up in order to really focus on, and I use the phrase lightly, warfighting, because it's up to warfighting, and I know that's a contentious word to use. But our point there is that we are trying to maximise the integration of the of agencies across across the government, and also maximise the limited resources that we have available to us. The JEF and the CJEF I described earlier. So, how have we done our wargaming? Well, my personal wargaming started with dice rolling and hobby gaming, building models, not knowing what they were doing, a bunch of eight-year-olds sitting around a table making stuff up, which is terribly exciting, as I'm sure you will agree. It then progressed in my military career into how to use these fantastic AFV, armoured fighting vehicle recognition models that I saw around the place as an armoured infantry battle group. All these opportunities to actually train using armoured vehicles on a table, because we couldn't always get out and use the armoured vehicles for real. Finding means to inspire my young soldiers into learning more about their business. And that was a really kind of fascinating experience for me, but wasn't very fashionable and therefore got ignored quite gratuitously. One company commander thought it was brilliant, second company commander thought it was rubbish, third company commander thought I was really dull. As a company commander, before I took command of my rifle company, I was in Iraq for a very long time, working alongside some American colleagues. American colleagues had with them some dice and some little 28mm figures, and they got me back into it in a way that I hadn't really expected to. It was really quite fun, particularly for them playing out real-life historical events. 1993 Somalia, it kind of brought it up to date. It looked really interesting. It kept me interested. There was real video, there were films, you know, there was a lot around the whole thing, and we played some really interesting games, took our mind off the issue, but we were able to bring insights out and take it ourselves. When I came back from Afghanistan, I discovered this company, Radio Dish Dash, who produced Skirmish Sangin, 28mm figures again, really low-down skirmish activity, 8-15 characters on the board, fighting about 4 or 5 characters, bad guys, pretty good squad-level activity. I used that as a company commander to work with my my section commanders and my sergeants to actually attribute the qualities of their soldiers to the qualities of the tokens on the board, and for them to use the soldiers and limit their aspiration by the limit of the quality of their soldiers. I'm not going to pretend it improved my soldiers' fitness. I'm not going to pretend it improved their marksmanship so that they could get a better part to play in the game. But it really made the platoon commanders and platoon sergeants think about the real problems they face with their men, rather than just moving tokens around quite agnostically. So as a company commander, commanding officer, first commanding officer wasn't interested, second commanding officer wasn't interested, so it didn't really kind of go anywhere beyond my company. When I went back as second in command, commanding officer was quite inspired by it. We went to the Sandhurst conference a couple of years ago, 2014, I think. He was inspired. He said it was great. Let's do more of this. And we tried to use advanced squad leader as a mechanism for wargaming, company versus company competition, to try and get that going, inspired, I know, by some of the comments made by Eva Gardner. And We then took Skirmish Sangin back into the companies. Ironically, it was a Royal Marine officer pictured there who really understood how to make it work with his soldiers. He got really excited by it and we got going and doing it. Taking insights from other people, particularly One Royal Irish, we identified that making people do this during daytime work time was better than making them do it out of their work time. It wasn't a hobby, it was a professional education, hence why young officers around a table after lunch finding the problems. Some of the insights in that, you start shooting at them, they start wanting to shoot back and ignore the mission, which is a fascinating insight into young men's mentality. When I moved to the SJF HQ, I was very lucky that I came with a little bit of heritage of wargaming, amateur playing around, I think, and I had a commander who wanted to innovate. Wargaming, low price, easy setup, easy to, you know, if it fails, no one's going to get too excited about it, and we had good opportunity. We did a lot of cooperation with DSTL in designing designing war games, a lot of work with DSTL developing alternative thinking techniques, and the two go together quite well. We also, I must admit, to kind of being a bit of a blind panic, trying to find games that we could play in the Stirling Joint Force headquarters. Last year, I sent some of the SO2s down to the game here, the Aftershock game, to learn about how to use wargaming techniques in that way. We developed a kind of common understanding of pack sims as a web resource, people trying to identify problems with that. And when I attended the cyber operations core course, we saw matrix wargaming being used for the first time effectively. We took that, and that has been the basis of what we've done. We've also been very lucky in that DSTL providing us with, on the left-hand side is an information activity and operations war game, and on the right-hand side, a messaging war game, which we've been supported in, and we've supported development of those particular war games. I'm going to go through three matrix war games that we've conducted to give a bit of an insight. The Exercise Baltic Challenge, which associated with the Baltic Sea. You understand the Jeff, we're quite interested about the Baltic region. Depending on who you talk to, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, Northern Europe, I'm not quite sure who, but depending on your perspective, it's whether it's a 6 or a 9, but it's quite interesting getting that anyway. We used it the first time, the beginning of January last year, to really get people thinking about the problems associated with their own mindset and getting into the idea of role-playing, and the idea of role-playing to develop an insight into the adversary. The problem was that obviously people wanted to win. They were more concerned about the rules than they were about actually the kind of benefits they could get from that. And we solved that. But one of the things that came up was we constantly came up against that problem in the bottom right-hand corner of every action having its counteraction or reaction. Well, actually, it's not just a reaction. It's lots and lots of reactions. And that balance that we've gone on to try and work out of whether your deterrent activity is reassuring or it's provoking, or whether when you're deliberately provocative, are you actually deterring or are you reassuring? It's a kind of really fascinating triangle that we try to work our way through. A couple of months later, we used another war game, this one a kind of a Black Sea challenge. The reason we used a Black Sea scenario was we wanted to take it away from the Baltic region, but we wanted to focus on being Russia-facing still. And so that was a fascinating game. We had just had 2 days of academics instruction on Russia, and so it was a perfect time to actually be doing Russian-focused games. People were more familiar with the game set. They were really focusing on not just the actions they wanted to take, but they were focusing on the effects they wanted to have and focusing on the consequences that would come from that and focusing on the consequence management. So we managed to have, you know, take people's thinking a long way. But really facing against a Russian-type threat, which was really, really important. The bottom right-hand tile is really fascinating. On the 17th of March when we did this, there was an aircraft shot down in real time at 10:30 as we were having coffee. So at 11 o'clock when we started again, that was used as a reset for the next part of the game. Now what are we going to do? And the interesting there is that all four of those tiles, if you look at them carefully, are the same story within 10 minutes of the action taking place. And they are four different perspectives. Four different players got four different tiles showing them this is what's happened, and they played along that news feed for the next couple of rounds. That was fascinating. What was equally fascinating was the UK response, which was we're going to ignore it for 6 months and see what happens. We then got to our really big game in April this year, which was I was supported very heavily, supported entirely by DSTL to provide a war game to really focus on joint theatre entry and anti-access and area denial problems. The top right-hand corner is my boss's conceptual map of all the issues associated with deterrence and anti-access denial, anti-access and area denial. The bottom left-hand corner was really what we were trying to focus on. What is the distinction between the force you use to deploy and how you employ the force? What is the balance there about the force structure, the force laydown, the force flows, all those sort of issues? Do the tanks you need to land on Omaha Beach, are they ideal for the tanks to drive into Berlin? What's more important, getting to Berlin or getting off the beach? And there's that really interesting problem that we had to, which we were trying to focus through there. And that lasted over 2 days. The insight there is that we did a three-round game. Round one, you are the Jeff, you need to deploy. This is what you're deploying for. Go and work that out as a bunch of teams, four or five teams who worked out their problems. They all came back with the same problem and the same problem set, came back with five different solutions, which was quite interesting. We then sent them away for lunch, came back, the room had been turned inside out, there were gold stars everywhere, red stars everywhere, a couple of Chinese hats for some reason, hello. Deliberately, we changed the headquarters into a Russian-minded headquarters, and they played the second round as Russians. So really getting them into that set. And the third round, we tried to fuse the two together to come up with some common understanding of what is simple for us, what's difficult for them, using the whole range of, how do we access the whole range of capabilities in the UK, whereas our adversaries have access to the whole range of their capabilities. So like to say it was successful, at least my OJAR says it was successful. That's how our journey has gone on. Some of the issues that we've come across that I think are interesting for you, particularly last turn madness, when they can see it's going to finish at 2 o'clock, how do I win? Hence why in one of the first war games, Russia invaded Gotland. Not quite sure why they did it, it's just they wanted to do something and they hadn't done anything really significant up until then. The second one is about the wrong map. It's the wrong map, the map's too small, the map's too large. One great insight is the very senior officer looked at Kaliningrad and said, why is that bit of Russia there? Which I thought was brilliant. Two bits we found very interesting, though, is about articulation of risk, getting people to articulate their risk, and then giving them the dice and saying, go on then, that's what you said the risk is, that's what we think it is, there's the dice, roll on it. I'm not really sure I want to do that now. Well, there you are, that's an interesting thing, is that you were quite happy to advise the commander on that basis and tell him the risk quite loosely, but when given the dice yourself, you weren't quite sure whether you wanted to do that. The articulation of effect, of trying to identify what the effects are, and people tended off, when at the beginning of this, being very binary, it's going to go well, it's going to go badly, until towards the end we got into the point where people were able to identify six or eight different consequences that could come from an event, and try to articulate those, and try and say how they're going to mitigate those before they even roll the dice. Really fascinating seeing how that changed. The development of our consequence management, we saw it over the course of 7 months, people moving from not really caring about the consequences because they weren't thinking that far ahead, to when things were problems that hadn't even been identified by people were being solved before they're being identified, if that makes sense. I mean, people were looking so far into what the consequences of actions were, they were really working hard to manage them before they came about. And the last point there is about when to use wargaming. We used wargaming in trying to understand the problem, we used wargaming in trying to understand the doctrine, we used wargaming in trying to understand our own understanding of the problem, and really used it all the way through the system, and the opportunity to just take the tools and use them. The two last insights didn't get on here last night, or a couple of nights ago, and I think really worthwhile, is that we have received pushback from within the community already, the army, joint operations, we're doing some wargaming, and immediately people saying, yeah, we don't really like the name, why are you calling it wargaming, isn't that a little bit aggressive? And that's really disturbing when it comes from Foreign Office officials. How do we get the point across to them? And the second one is that the use of real scenarios we found really, 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 really useful. two parts. One, we've been able to get our partners across government and agencies involved because they've been real problems. They don't really want to learn a fake problem to then practice with it. So that's been really, really, really good. The problem we have is that we exercise in fake scenarios, but we can war game in real scenarios to provide us insights for those fake scenarios. And that's what we've tried to achieve. And that apparently is the right map, if anyone needs a global view. So yeah.